Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time airport lounge occupant.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that features three people who seldom, if ever, try to be anything different from what we are on a daily basis. That is, as long as you ignore Mary Pat's tendency to wish she were always visiting some foreign site somewhere instead of tending anything remotely smacking of domestic chores. Am I right, MP?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this past week saw the three of us taking in a pair of movies that feature actors taking on roles that force us to see them in a different way. First up is Queer, director Luca Guadagnino's adaptation of the William S. Burroughs 1985 novella of the same name, starring Daniel Craig. Then we'll follow with Maria, the Pablo Larraín study of the final week in the life of the famed soprano Maria Callas, starring Angelina Jolie. Let's begin by heading to Mexico City during the 1950s. It is there that William Lee, played by Daniel Craig, lives, haunting the Mexican capital's streets and gay bars, looking for love and settling for whatever chance encounters he can find. Then he meets the tall, thin Eugene Allerton, played by Drew Starkey, is completely taken and sets out to seduce him. His efforts begin in the city itself and then continue during an extended trek the two make through South America, where, with the help of a researcher played by Leslie Manville, they end up experiencing a hypnotic journey courtesy of a plant distilled into the hallucinogen ayahuasca. What's most intriguing about Guadagnino's film, other than his usual skillful narrative style and the desperate emotional needs exhibited by Craig's character Lee, is the performance of Craig himself, a veteran actor best known for portraying the steadfastly heterosexual James Bond in five 007 films. And if that doesn't surprise you, then the acting jobs put in by the barely recognizable Manville and Jason Schwartzman likely will.
Daniel Craig's performance here did not surprise me because all the way through Queer, I was thinking, you know, his version of Lee, who is basically a fictionalized version of William S. Burroughs, is a lot closer to Benoit Blanc, his character in the Knives Out movies, than I was expecting. So he has done work kind of like this. But what might be surprising is, and not for Guadagnino, but for an actor of Craig's, you know,
stature?
Yeah, stature is the frankness of the sexuality in this movie. Yep. I'm sure Sean Connery is rolling over in his grave. Isn't that great?
As is Roger Moore.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, they're great guys, weren't they? But this is also Luca Guadagnino's second film in 2024 after Challengers was finally released earlier this year. And both of those are movies that have very bold aesthetic and stylistic choices. Both of them are movies about sexuality and obsession. They even share the same screenwriter. They share the same cinematographer. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross did the music for both films. But these movies look and move and behave very differently. And this, Queer, is also really only the second major film adaptation of work by William S. Burroughs, following the 1991 film Naked Lunch, which was directed by David Cronenberg. And these movies actually do have some things in common beyond the Burroughs connection. They both borrow details from Burroughs' own life.
Right.
They take the novels and then they sort of put some biography in there. And there are similar images and even passages of dialogue that pop up in both movies. But I think that Queer probably reflects Burroughs' style of writing, perhaps even more closely than Cronenberg's film did. It's really a movie about, it's not really about people. It's not even really about story or plot. It's more about sensation and feeling, about euphoria, about sickness, addiction,
desperation.
Absolutely. These different states of mind and being, especially when you get into that passage you mentioned about the ayahuasca trip in the jungle. It's about all of these weird ideas that can come together to make a work of art. So there are individual images and sounds and songs and colors and pictures that stick in my mind about Queer more so than what the overall structure of the narrative might be.
Or where it's going. Yeah,
absolutely. And honestly, I feel the same way about both of these movies, about Naked Lunch and Queer. But I think I find Cronenberg's vision of Burroughs' work a little more confounding in a delightful kind of way. I mostly found Queer sort of confounding in an intriguing way. The pacing of the film is a little slack to me, especially in that third act, despite the fact that it does have that insane drug trip in it. And that I did not realize that was Leslie Manville. I forgot she was in the opening credits. And then afterward, I went, That's who that was. But again, there are images in this movie that are so striking. There's one during that final part that I talked about where these two characters' bodies seem to sort of melt into one another. And that is one of the most potent visual interpretations I've ever seen for a physical kind of closeness like the two characters have in this movie. So there's a lot to grapple with in Queer, as there tends to be in Guadagnino's film. So I came away from this, again, being intrigued, not totally satisfied, but God, I just love the fact that this guy is being given almost, it seems, carte blanche to do whatever he wants, because he's producing some wild movies. And I still think Challengers is my favorite of his films in 2024.
It's certainly audacious try to convert Burroughs' written material.
To try and adapt him in the first place.
Right, exactly. So I think Guadagnino deserves a shout out for that alone. And Queer, the movie, is largely faithful to the book. I mean, there's dialogue taken word for word in multiple sections. And some of the characters, you know, at first, I wasn't really sure that the Jason Schwartzman character, I mean, I think it was supposedly based on Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, sure.
But Manola Dargis sort of called out the character or his performance or something, and I'm not sure I understood what her primary complaint was. But to see Daniel Craig in this setting, willing to also be audacious in his choice of roles, I mean, I thought was definitely worth watching. And the book and the movie end differently, and I'm not going to say too much more about that, but the book isn't really even a book. It's more like a novella. Mm-hmm. So I think you could read it in a couple of hours, no problem. But just trying to do what Guadagnino does, and you know, we didn't talk about Call Me By Your Name or A Bigger Splash, which are sort of a little bit more Italy-focused in terms of their orientation.
Or I Am Love, which was like his breakthrough.
Yeah. I mean, so I really enjoy watching his films, even if I was a little confounded by different aspects of this one.
Yeah, I mean, Guadagnino is another one of those filmmakers, and, you know, I can name a half dozen who, if I see his name, I'm going to go watch his movies, simply because there's always something interesting to see. Even if I wasn't all that high on this film, simply for a lot of the reasons that you even talked about, Nathan, that for me, it just didn't seem to go anywhere. It's a movie that I think you could wrap up in 10 words or less, which is looking for love in all the wrong places, and you're going to find it at least for a while.
Now that song's stuck in my head for the day.
But I think that, well, first of all, we need to warn that this is a hard R film, that there are a lot of very graphic sexual scenes.
Can you imagine walking into this movie and being blindsided by that?
No,
How dumb do you have to be?
And but I thought that they were artfully filmed for the most part. No, I mean, it wasn't, the drug use
and the drinking is actually probably more graphic.
Is there a scene, can you think of a scene in which he doesn't have a cigarette hanging out of his mouth? I mean,
well, he walks around in a fog of tequila and regret and longing.
Yeah. Right. You mentioned just briefly the music. I was taken in the first 10 minutes, there's two versions of Nirvana songs.
Yeah.
And I went, okay, you got me here. Yeah. You know?
Well, I was puzzling over that because there's a scene, it's a long, slow walk through an alleyway in this village, and it's in slow motion, and I think he plays the entirety of Nirvana's Come As You Are.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that is anachronistic. Nirvana was not around at the time.
But wasn't there a use of All Apologies also?
Yeah, the Sinead O'Connor cover in the trailer and in the opening credits. He also uses some Prince deep cuts. He uses a New Order song at one point. And I don't know. I was wondering why he chose those songs.
Well,
it's kind of what Sofia Coppola did with Marie Antoinette.
I mean, we talked a little bit about the fact before we went on the air that Burroughs, I mean, we associated him, you know, with the Beat Generation. But it turns out, I mean, he lived until the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And he actually involved himself in these collaborative artistic endeavors with Nirvana, with, you know, other people.
I think he
lived
until the 90s even, because he's in Drugstore Cowboy, the Gus Van Sant movie. But yeah, you're right. Like, he absolutely influenced a lot of those rock and roll subcultures. And so maybe that's kind of a tip of the hat to that. I also wanted to point out that there's a moment in this movie, in Queer, where the two main characters go to a screening of Jean Cocteau's film Orpheus, which is about, you know, it's about the myth, about the, you know, this guy kind of descending into the underworld. And I think that is a tip off to what Guadagnino's trying to do with this movie. It also kind of feels like the entire film is what happened after the Lee character already descended into that underworld of his own making. So if you think about it in that way, I think it works.
At any rate, that was our discussion of Luca Guadagnino's film Queer. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to talk about Pablo Larraín's look at the late opera diva Maria Callas, as played by Angelina Jolie. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
70% of our listeners prefer to purchase products and services from public radio program underwriters, according to a recent NPR survey. Spokane Public Radio listeners appreciate program underwriters because they also help support the station and programs they listen to each and every day. You can find information about becoming a program underwriter and our current underwriters on our website at SpokanePublicRadio.org under Business Support Underwriting. Through this relationship, we can all help keep the region growing strong, whether it's our diverse business community or Spokane Public Radio.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Luca Guadagnino's film Queer, starring Daniel Craig. Let's now turn to another film streaming on Netflix that features a movie star stepping into a role that casts her in a light that feels far different from her more noted roles. Pablo Larraín's study of the late, great opera soprano Maria Callas, titled simply Maria, starring Angelina Jolie. Larraín, as you may know, specializes in his own style of biographical studies, having tackled the lives of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis in 2016's Jackie and Britain's Princess Diana in 2021's Spencer. Now in Maria, which stars Angelina Jolie, he takes on the woman whose story was a part of Larraín's Jackie film, she being the lover that Greek shipping tycoon Aristotle Onassis threw over to marry the assassinated President John F. Kennedy's widow. Larraín, working from a script by Stephen Knight, author of Spencer, fashions his film as the final week of La Callas' life as she, heavily medicated by a bevy of drugs, including the narcotic Mandrax, known popularly in the U.S. as Quaalude, flits back and forth between reality and fantasy. Buoyed by a loyal staff, butler Ferruccio, played by Pier Francesco Favino, and housemaid Bruna, played by Alba Rohrwacher, La Callas to fans but Maria to intimates works with a pianist in an attempt to see if she can reclaim her past glory as a singer. But two, she engages with a fantasy presence of a journalist called, tellingly, Mandrax, played by Cody Smith McPhee. Larraín resorts to an accentuated style, especially during black-and-white flashbacks and seeming newsreel-type touches. But his greatest feat is in casting Jolie, whose at times icy demeanor captures the full effect of the diva that the real-life La Callas likely was.
This film is difficult to separate from the performance by, as you pointed out, its lead actor, Angelina Jolie, and sort of the way that the story focuses on only one small aspect of this woman's life. And I guess I'm going to be critical to some extent about the movie Maria, not because of the performances, because they're all very good, but because I felt as though, unlike the other two, and I'm not saying that the other two films, Jackie and Spencer, were focused on these people who everyone knows because popular culture has made them into these super iconic figures. And Marie Callas is a little bit more mysterious. And so I felt in many respects this film, which is decidedly not a biopic, just like the other two were not biopics either, just really didn't capture the grandeur of who she was and what she meant to the opera world at the time, you know, she sort of dominated performances across the globe. And so in that respect, I guess she just seems so almost pathetic. And I don't think that that's doing her any great service. Now, having said that, I thought the set design, I thought many aspects of this film really captured my attention throughout. But I'm just struggling a little bit with the film and some of the director's choices overall.
Well, and I think it's impossible to watch this and not connect it to those previous Lorraine films that are so similar in terms of focus and theme and even style in a lot of ways. I would say in terms of how much I've liked them, Maria falls in between Jackie and Spencer, for me at least. But I mean, all three of them are about, you know, the interiority and the turmoil of these misunderstood historical women from recent history, of course. But in this case, you have someone whose personal life often overshadowed their artistry. In the case of Jackie O and Princess Diana, you know, they weren't known for the
art.
Right.
I mean, and I think that's important, too, because we know about them primarily because of their association with powerful men.
Right.
Whereas Callas, you know, had this stature in her own right.
But then
even though she was associated with Onassis.
Yeah, yeah. And again, like, you know, later in her life, that seemed to eclipse the fact that she was this great star. And it wasn't until after her death that people went, you know, we really took her talent for granted and only focused on these sort of tabloid pieces of her life. And it didn't help that, you know, she was one of those maligned women in history that didn't do herself many favors when she was alive. But of course, now we know that she was taking all these drugs and probably had an eating disorder and had all of this trauma in her past that was making her this way, making her act out this way.
And I'm going to push back a little bit, and maybe it's because I know a little bit more about Maria Callas's life, and you do too, Mary Pat, because we saw several years ago a really good documentary about her life.
Oh, yeah.
But there were things in Maria that I did not know. I did not know that her mother Ponderoff, I mean, she was American-born, but raised in Greece. And during World War II, her mother Ponderoff to German officers who both had her sing, but we suspect used her sexually also. So she had a really rough childhood. And, you know, all right, we didn't find out how she became the great soprano that she did become. But there are scenes, particularly at the very end of the film, which are total fantasy, but it's Lorraine's kind of fantasy, in which as she's singing, the street, everyone's looking up at her, you know, and she just hypnotizes everyone with her great voice. So, you know, in a fantastic kind of way, I think Lorraine is paying her due credit.
Although earlier in the movie, there's a similar moment where all these people in that same square are coming at her and singing at her. And so there you
and
sort
that's
of see
her
that,
fantasy.
Yeah, you sort of see that dichotomy there. To me, the most interesting elements in Maria were the details inside the house, which I think we're to assume are not fantasy, but maybe they are, I don't know. But she has these kind of strained relationships with the members of staff that you mentioned. The ways in which she then will leave the house and go out in public as if she just wants to be recognized. She'll go to this cafe and just sort of almost like lounge. She like drapes herself on this table and is almost waiting to be recognized. And then when she is recognized, she starts berating the person because they looked at her wrong or they said the wrong thing. And she says to one of the servers at one point, he says, "Can I get you something to eat?" And she says, "I don't come to restaurants to eat. I come to restaurants to be adored." And, you know, and so you get a sense of sort of this irascibility that makes her an interesting figure. In retrospect, I think that the conceit to make this sort of a string of drug-fueled fantasies or nightmares or flashbacks, whatever you want to call them, it's actually really similar to Queer. It's kind of funny that we paired these movies because they have a lot in common. That particular conceit sometimes worked for me and sometimes didn't. And so I don't know. I think I'm more in your camp, MP, of being sort of held at arm's length by this movie when I think it wanted me to be enraptured and swept away by this person and by her talent.
And that's funny because, you know, she, of the three, the trilogy that we're talking about, Mary Pat, I think you rank this one as third, right?
Correct.
And you rank it second. I rank it first.
Interesting.
And that may be simply because I don't really remember the other two very well, and this is the most recent one, but I really, really loved what Angelina Jolie did here.
She's good. She's good.
She is so good. It's, I mean, obviously, it's not her singing. It is.
Yeah, she's lip syncing. Yeah,
but
well,
she
there's
does
amalgamation. Apparently.
Apparently, but she does it flawlessly, and it's just her diction. Also, it's an accent that many American actors can't do. It isn't European. It isn't American. It's somewhere in between, but it's certainly regal. And I have never liked her more than I liked her in this movie. And this is an Academy Award winning actress.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, looking at that, I think that it's one of those roles that you keep waiting to descend into histrionics or into bad melodrama or into camp. I mean, even the line that I quoted earlier, it has kind of like a Mommy Dearest sort of camp element. You could almost imagine 1970s Faye Dunaway playing this part, right? 1980s Faye Dunaway. And it would be a totally different movie. And I also appreciated the fact that Maria wasn't like another Netflix-funded film about a maligned woman. I was thinking of Blonde, the Marilyn Monroe mm-hmm. movie, and Marilyn, of course, makes a cameo in,
yes,
in Maria.
Yes, she does, singing Happy Birthday, yeah, to, Mr. President.
To JFK, of course. I'm glad that it didn't descend into that kind of despair for the only purpose of being despairing. You know what I mean? Where sometimes yes. they look back at, oh, it's the last week of Maria Callas's life, and I think, oh, this is just going to be a trudge. And it isn't that. And so I at least appreciated the fact that it didn't just stay at that level all the
way. Well, and I think that we did feel the sort of agony of someone who had this, you know, monumental talent, who then, because of ailments or health-related concerns, mm-hmm. was not able to continue performing as long as she hoped or wanted or expected. And so
I think she had to stop when she was 49.
Yeah, wow. Which is for opera singers. I mean, sometimes they linger a little longer
right,
than that.
Right.
But it was the whole, I mean, she talked about the feeling of power and, you know, euphoria that she got from being on stage. And so trying to replicate that experience in a corner cafe probably didn't cut it for her.
Yeah, decidedly so, I believe.
But next time I'm out eating, I'm going to say, I come to restaurants to be adored. That's my new line.
Yeah, we'll come with you.
Oh, thank you.
And we'll adore you. At any rate, that was our discussion of the Netflix offering, Maria. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbitt and Pat Truthart and I discussed Luca Guadagnino's film Queer. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the late William S. Burroughs. There is no intensity of love or feeling that does not involve the risk of crippling hurt. It is a duty to take this risk, to love and feel without defense or reserve. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.